My name is Jim Wong. I directed this movie.
I'm Glenn Morgan. I'm the writer-producer.
I'm Jim Koblenz, the editor.
Hi, my name is Jeffrey Reddick, and I'm one of the writers of Final Destination.
The title Final Destination, we wanted the movie to be called Flight 180. It was always called Flight 180, and the last minute, New Line was concerned that it might seem like it was Airport 77 or Air Force One type turbulence disaster movie, and we fought it and lost, but we always thought the title should be Flight 180.
Upcoming, you'll see a lot of stuff that's kind of related to 180. We thought that would be a much more effective way to creep the audience out.
The initial idea for Final Destination came to me when I was trying to get a television agent, and she told me to write for something that was really hot on television at the time, and I wrote an X-Files spec script with this concept inside of it. One day I was riding on a plane, and I was reading a story about somebody who had a premonition and got off a flight, and that just kind of sparked interest in me, and I said that'd be interesting, because what if these people that got off the flight were supposed to be on it, and what if they missed their time to die and death came after them again? So it's kind of come full circle because, you know, James Wong and Glenn Morgan, who are two of the best guys from the X-Files, you know, are back on the project now. And I just think that's kind of ironic since it started out as a X-Files TV script.
That's the other thing, just to start out. You know, when the movie comes out and you read the critics, and I think they all feel that you're back there going, hey, you know, what a great classic we've made. And, you know, we know what works and what doesn't work in the movie, and I don't think any of us here are. I'm saying you should be listening to commentary of Russ Meyer or Martin Scorsese.
Yeah, well, anyways, we're doing this because hopefully you'll enjoy some of the behind-the-scenes stuff.
When I was 15 years old, I was in Kentucky, and I saw the first Nightmare on Elm Street movie, and I thought it was one of the best horror movies I'd ever seen, and totally blew me away. So I didn't know anything about the film industry, but I wrote Bob Shea, who was the chairman of New Line Cinema, a letter and a treatment that I'd written for a prequel to Nightmare on Elm Street. And he sent it back to me unread with a form letter saying, you know, we don't take unsolicited material. Everything has to come through an agent. So I didn't really want to take no for an answer, so I wrote him back kind of a nasty letter. And I was like, look, I've seen 5 of your movies. I spent like $25 on New Line Cinema, so you can at least take 10 minutes to read my stuff. And fortunately, he read it, and he wrote me back a very encouraging letter, you know, with some critiques, but he was very encouraging and told me to keep at it. And after that, I started kind of stalking his office and writing his assistant, Joy, and getting Nightmare on Elm Street memorabilia. And every time a new movie would come out, they would send me stuff, and I would write stories and send them back to New Line. And this went through high school and into my freshman year or sophomore year of college, and I came to New York for a summer field study. And Joy said, why don't you come in and see if we have any internships for you? And I got an internship in marketing, and I've been there ever since, like 11 years now.
This is a superstition of mine. I still have airline tags from going to Vancouver when we worked on the commish in my luggage. Because if it made it the first time, then you're okay.
17. When we did this scene, one of the most memorable things about this was in this bedroom, Devin had to pretend to be sleeping in the next scene coming up, when in fact he actually fell asleep for a good 4 hours. We couldn't wake him up.
Yeah, this was the first day.
There he is, right there. First day, sleeping on the job, and we actually worked all around him for like 4 hours, and he never woke up.
That's acting.
A lot of the people involved in this project at the end of the day were ex-Newliners, or people who've worked there before. And one of my really good friends, Chris Bender, went to work for a producer, Warren Zeid. And they came to me one day and said, you know what, you know, Scream's come out, it's really hot, we want to do a horror movie, and we know that you have like 50 ideas. So why don't you send them over? And I sent, you know, a list of ideas over to Warren Zeid, and this is the one that they really like. So we spent about 6 months working on the treatment. You know, it started off as a 3-page treatment, to, you know, the movie form of it did. And, you know, we brought the project to New Line Cinema, and, you know, they didn't show any favoritism. They've read a couple of my projects before and passed on them, but we submitted it to New Line, and they liked the story a lot. And, you know, I was signed to write the first draft.
This thing with the clock.
That particular shot that showed the clock changing to flight 180, took us literally, I think, 5 different days of shooting it to make it work. It was much more complicated than it actually appears in the movie.
This is a Vancouver airport, and we had to shoot in this direction because the other direction had the Canadian flag, and they wouldn't take it down.
Right.
Which would be weird to be flying at JFK.
What are you doing?
He's the man. The man.
All right.
I guess this stuff introduces the characters, and we had written a lot of kind of a, I wouldn't call it an inside joke, but kind of nods to great horror filmmakers of the past. And again, the critics were like, if you're going to invoke those names, you better live up to it. But a lot of these guys didn't make, and all their films were terrific. This is Mr. Murnau, who did directed Nosferatu. And that's Todd Wagner and his brothers George Wagner. George Wagner directed The Wolfman and The Batman TV series.
And Devin's character, his last name is Browning. And of course,
he did Dracula and Freaks and The Unholy Three and The Unknown. So if you take Alex Browning and Todd
Wagner,
you get Todd Browning. This is Clear Rivers, who is named not after
a famous director, but actually our assistant, whose name is Clear.
And Rivers is a friend of our family's who bought me our family's greatest dog. Kristen here, she's Val Luton, and he produced Curse of the Cat People and Cat People and I Walked with a Zombie and The Seventh Victim, a lot of these great movies.
In the Expo script, the character that I had the premonition was Scully's brother Charles, who was like the brother that we never really see anything of on the show. So when I translated it to a feature, we made them all adult characters because I just thought that would be an interesting field of mine and some psychology we hadn't seen before in a horror movie. But then Scream was out, and we all talked about it, and we kind of had to give in a little bit. And we're like, okay, let's make them teenagers, but we'll make them smart teenagers. So they weren't like silly psycho fodder running around having sex and getting hacked up or anything.
Now this board actually does not exist in the airport, and we didn't even build it. This existed only in the computer. So this is a CGI effect, even though you wouldn't think it would be.
There's Billy Hitchcock. I guess I'm a freak, but when I go to the airport, I'm always looking for signs that I should not get on the plane. So you have the words terminal and departed, which you think that they would change that in an airport. They'd come up with different words. He was born. His departure time is the same day as his birthday.
Little gag we had.
We actually reshot the tag so we could put the words final destination on the tag after the name change of the movie.
But what John Willett did, in the background there's all murals. All those murals are of different ways that people are going to die.
Again, this plane does not exist in real life. It's only in the computer. Actually, it's a model that we put, composited into this scene. Right? And you'll see the rain, which looks pretty good. But you'll see that there's nobody in the pilot's or the co-pilot's seat up there in the plane, because we couldn't afford to have animated objects.
The toilets and coach are barely ventilated closets, all right, if that.
And we had to decide whether we would spend the money at the Vancouver airport or whether we would build this entire set, which we decided to do because we had more control. If you want, and it's tough to blow out windows in an airport.
Yeah, they will not let us.
They frown on that a little.
Now this kind of bit with a John Denver happened to me at the Vancouver airport when I was working on Millennium. I was about to board a plane, and it wasn't Rocky Mountain High, but John Denver came over the PA, and it was just a few weeks after he had died in a plane crash, and I was like,
wait a second,
if they play Glenn Miller, Buddy Holly, I'm not getting on the plane.
I guess this was a set that the way we did the shot, we yanked the door of the bathrooms out as the camera descended so that the arm of the crane could fit in there.
And we took this up gate 46. That's the number of kids that were
in the class that were gonna die.
And it played with sound a lot in here. It'll be like we echoed the tears and things, and to add to his premonition, let you to just enhance it a little bit.
This gangway, actually, if you look very closely, you'll see their heads are coming very close to the top of the ceiling because we did a forced perspective set that made it seem like it was much longer than it actually was. And I wanted to get that weird feeling where suddenly they seemed to be, the world was closing in on them in the previous gangway set.
And the security guard at the end is actually...
There's, if you look closely earlier in the scene when the two girls were walking down the way, there's a man walking down way into the gangway, and that person was actually a little person. He was only like 4 feet high. They looked normal size because of the forced perspective.
The guy who was driving the luggage cart there was the production designer, John Willett.
And if you notice, the cart also had 666 on it.
And this is all more of our kind of superstitions about boarding the plane. That is, does the paint look good on the door? How kind of high up are you? What's your seat number? And all this kind of...
baloney.
Neurotic behavior.
Yeah. Everyone has.
Now this set was on a, this was like a 20 feet off the ground on a hydraulic gimbal.
Yeah, this plane is a set, of course. And when we shot in it, we had to put all these stairs up onto it and then have the stairs be released so that the plane can move when we were shooting. So each take, if we want to change something, it took a long time because it keep putting the stairs up and attaching the stairs to the set and then taking the stairs out whenever we want to shoot. So it took a long time to shoot. It took a week and a half to shoot this sequence in the plane.
Yeah, that gimbal could, you know, you imagine if you took a coach compartment that you sit in and raise it like at a 90-degree angle and then tip it over, I don't know, 45-degree angle or something like that.
It looked like a gigantic mechanical bull. It was amazing to watch. Because of you, I got
to sit here and watch. That joke about Greenland, I would like to cut out, but we were tied into a...
Thank you. Touché.
Yeah.
Sorry, I'm late.
Sean Scott, who played Stifler in American Pie. Billy was the first, I think the kind of chubby nerd guy. And casting Sean, I think, was a good thing because it took away from that cliche, and he came up with a lot of his own jokes.
Well, the characters in the movie, the characters in my draft were similar, but a couple of them were different. I mean, for the lead of Alex, I actually really wanted to get Tobey Maguire for Alex. I think he's a great actor, and I wanted somebody who wasn't a typical Hollywood pretty boy, but somebody who's a solid actor. And I think actually Devin Sawa captured that really well. He's very relatable, and I think he's a very talented actor. And, you know, there are two brother characters in the script, and Todd and his brother George. And in my draft, they were actually two sisters. And this is totally me being, I guess, a studio head, too, but I actually wanted to get Brandy for the sister that lives. And, then, you know, everybody at New Line kind of laughed at me, but then she ended up in I Know What You Did Last Summer, too, so I don't think it was that far off. But, you know, I think the actor Kier Smith that plays Carter is really good too. I mean, my kind of jock jerk was Todd, and I really hadn't figured out who I wanted to cast for him yet. And I wanted to get Kirsten Dunst for the role of Kimberly, aka Clear Now. That's who I really kind of envisioned for that character. But I think Ali Larter is good as well.
That's Randy Stone, who we've worked with. He casts X-Files.
This kind of also goes back to working at New Line, but another experience that I got to have on this film that a lot of writers don't get is I actually had a cameo in the movie, which got cut. But you know, I got to fly down to the set, and you know, I got to see actually them shooting the plane crash. You know, they had the plane set on a gimbal, and I got to meet all the actors and Ron and Morgan, which was really exciting. And I had a little trailer and stuff, so I got to kind of experience the other side of that as well. And it was just a real joy to meet the actual actors that were playing characters that, you know, I had come up with, or some of them were based on characters that I had come up with. And it was just amazing, you know, just to kind of get a sense of how, you know, much work and it goes into making a movie and just shooting a simple scene. It was just a great experience.
Coming here, there was that gentleman in front of the plane, there was a bit where his pants actually caught on fire, so we had to cut that out because it looked too stuntman-ish. But this part, all these people that get sucked out of the airplane, they were held together by a giant arm that we took out in the computer.
It sort of swung around to the other side of the plane. This thing right here, those are the guy that just fell down the aisle. He threw that radio, and that was the first take. He knocked Chad on the head there.
Yeah.
These are CGI flames.
Alex? Could you trace Cece's leg so she...
This is a note, too, in the script. You know, this is something that we didn't have that. You know, we just had the vision occurred, and then he got off, and Brian Whitten at New Line said, you know, we've got to show that the vision is actually occurring, and that's why this bit with the handle is in there. That was Brian Whitten's note.
Is there a problem, sir?
I also like the cutting across his neck and this premonition of what's going to happen to him. But no one knows it at this point.
This stuff's all shot first,
right,
before we did the plane.
Before we blew up the plane. So it was a testament to Devin, I guess, reacting to... I guess they always have to react to things that doesn't happen.
Go check him out, see how he's doing. Okay.
And again, in the background, as you'll see coming out, all those pictures in the background on the wall, they have something to do with what's going to happen in the rest of the movie.
Also, what John Willett did, I don't know if you can tell this by going back, but the murals, after they get off the plane here, the murals are all in a different position than what they were prior to boarding the plane.
In fact, the cappuccino bar that you see behind them, the set was entirely changed because we had this... We wanted that after the characters had cheated death, that everything was skewed. So a lot of the sets you'll see coming up, even though you may not notice for sure, there's a sense of there's nothing parallel on the the walls don't meet at 90 degrees, and things have changed in relation to each other.
Yeah, so that was moved closer to the gate, and the roof is lowered, but I don't know if we have a shot of the roof, really.
Yeah.
Back there, he says departed. Flight, you know, they're hanging that up. Flight 180's departed.
Parents
are on the way. And I don't know, you know, when we wrote the script, people comment, I think boarding a plane is actually more nerve-wracking than, you know, takeoff. I don't know why people feel that way. I don't know if it's, you know, they say that fear of flying is a loss of control. I don't know if you're going through the process of giving up, you know, your control.
I saw the ground and the cabin, it starts to shake, right? And the left side blows up, and then the whole plane just explodes. And it was so real, just like how everything happens, you know?
You've been on a lot of planes that blew up.
You must have fallen asleep.
Well, funny thing about I think you'll never notice, but it's one of the flight attendants in the background. From one day to the next, we had to change people because the girl didn't show up. So one of our PAs became one of the flight attendants right there in the background.
That's the model plane. There's a reflection put over the glass because we were on a set. And this next thing is something that we had in the script that we always wanted to do, and people got a little, well, why is it back that way? And it's kind of that, so Private Ryan with the sniper, or I had read about when they were first testing the Apollo Saturn V, that it would launch, and, you know, it took a moment for the, you know, concussion,
for the sound to hit you. So we saw the explosion first before we heard anything.
I think the next shot is...
This shot right here, see, the background of the picture next to her is a bus, and she will be, her demise will come from a bus. So stuff like that we had planned that no one knows about except is listening now, I guess, to us talking about.
Now this is always, you know, when we had our first screenings and stuff, I mean, the audience is kind of silent. Until this point where you had... Sean and Kristen kind of react, and you'd hear giggles in the audience, and you kind of realize that you had them a little better than which we thought. There was such silence after the plane crash that we thought, oh, people hate this.
Yeah, but you actually, we've discovered that.
Are there any survivors?
This is when they were hooked.
It was always, it was like a gauge with the animal.
Arsena. Why do you think I'm some sort of...
He's not a witch.
Yeah, Jim had boosted the sound on that door.
Yeah.
And this is Howard Siegel. Don Siegel had directed Invasion of the Body Snatchers.
Is there anyone here?
And back there, those characters are scripted as Whale and Arnold. James Whale had done Frankenstein.
Are there any survivors?
And Jack Arnold did Creature of the Black Lagoon. And the FBI agents are named Shrek and Ween, but we forgot which is which. And Max Schreck, he played, you know, Count Warlock and Nosferatu. And
this is Ween right here.
Okay, Ween, he directed Doctor Cabinet of Dr. Caligari, which kind of everybody should see.
It's
just great.
A couple questions regarding today's events. While they're still fresh in your mind, I'm sure this will prove invaluable to our rescue attempts and any potential criminal investigation.
Well, also, this room was timed to be much brighter than the next scene, which is supposed to be a huge contrast between light and darkness.
I got this feeling. This weird feeling.
This scene actually takes place in the real airport. This is one of the few scenes that takes place at
the administrative offices right upstairs at Vancouver Airport. Dan Roebuck, who's the...
Ween.
That guy. When he came in to audition, he was the only one that understood all the... who got the inside jokes about the names, and I had little resin models of Bride of Frankenstein and Phantom of the Opera. And he was all, oh, I'm all into that. So he said, we have to cast that guy because he's a horror movie fan.
And why did you really get off the plane?
My brother, Joe...
I think Chad and Kristen did a nice job here.
And keep an eye on Alex.
You have to lock down the camera?
Yeah. The way we did this, we wanted the background to remain the same while the people changed. So we, after the first interview with Devin, we locked down the camera. And just pop people in and out.
But I told him that he should go.
Very easy setups.
I sent him back on the plane.
Roger Smith, the other FBI agent, he's been in a lot of Spike Lee movies.
We forced you off the plane. You said you weren't.
I thought those guys did a good job from being the.
Yeah.
You know, they brought a kind of different take to those.
Because
you know, the law enforcement guys. When the original script had been the small town, or treatment rather, was a small town sheriff type thing, which you want to get away from because he thought the FBI would investigate a possible terrorist attack on an airplane.
And it went through so many changes. You know, we made first the characters were people who didn't know each other and they were adults. Then we made them teenagers, and then we, you know, we just kept changing the story. At first we had a slasher killer, and then we decided we didn't want to have that. We wanted to have death itself. And we personified it the first time, but then we decided that that was a little hokey too, so we went back and really made death more of a presence, somebody who kind of influenced life and got people to die, as opposed to somebody who just comes out and grabs them and kills them.
Now this shot is actually sped up of the car coming around the corner, because on the set there was actually no corner, so we had to start kind of slow.
My history at New Line kind of helped prepare me for this because, you know, I know kind of the rule of thumb is first-time writers especially always get rewritten. So, it, I mean, it doesn't make it easier because when you really put your heart and soul into a work, you know, you become attached to it. And I really did have to detach myself because at the end of the day, I knew the project was out of my hands. I mean, like I said, I had a little bit of say here and there about giving notes, but at the end of the day, my main concern just became that the movie turn out well. And I knew that, you know, the concept was mine, so I got better. I mean, it took a little bit of time, but I knew that was the business.
This is fabricated rain, although.
Right. Yeah. Although it rained almost every day.
Every day.
When we wanted it to rain, it didn't rain.
It's an exterior, but it's an interior. It's on a set.
This is actually a set.
And I remember Jim calling me saying, I know we're going to cover it, but I think I have this neat shot. Should we do it all this way?
Right.
It sounded like a really, you know, it's a pretty touching way. And it still has that feel of another entity outside, you know, watching him. John F. Kennedy Airport in New York. And so I think Jim did a good job on a lot of these shots that are very floating and moving as if it's a third, you know, party, somebody else, you know, watching
him. One of the first things I said when I finished the first draft of this script is, I think, and this isn't me trying to be like pretentious or anything, but, you know, I wanted to kind of elevate the bar. I mean, if you think about Friday the 13th in the 80s and what Nightmare on Elm Street did to the genre after that, I mean, it took it to a new level and a new direction. And you know, Scream was great. I know you did Last Summer. You know, it was a fun movie as well. But I think that when people start thinking about horror movies now, they want to do something more than just a slasher movie. And I think that this movie will actually kind of herald that next phase in. I mean, it takes something new coming along to kind of show them that the genre is almost limitless if you really kind of deal with, you know, real themes and real issues. I just think that it's not got nowhere to go but up.
Probably the maybe the least successful interpretation or translation from the script to the movie. There's this lightning bolt that you'll see. It's supposed to look like the hand of death pointing at Alex. As you can see, we never really quite got it. So what you see, what we decided at the end was just sort of have the lightning hit the ground, because we could never get the lightning to look quite.
It's supposed to be like his finger, as if it was pointing at Alex, yes. Like, I'm coming for you. Ariel Shaw supervised the effects. He did a great job, and I think none of us really kind of figured out how to do that.
Yeah, I just think, you know, I think I shot the plate wrong. We should have had a much wider sort of profile-y shot of the house, so you can get a kind of sense of depth, you know. So I think
this also in the script, a scene at the end has a bit where there's a singular cloud up in the sky that looks like it's hovering over just Alex, but it was a overcast day, so he just bailed on that. When the time falls suddenly upon them. This is also a thing where this memorial, the wings are a certain way, and then later...
Yeah, later it changes when... But you actually never see it later because we cut out the new ending.
Mm.
Upcoming, there's a song that's going to be starting right now, I think. And that song is written by our assistant's husband.
Yeah, we wanted to use Long May You Run by Neil Young, but it was like $250,000. And we're actually at the point where I go, oh, we're not going to have a song at the funeral. And
he just sent something up. It sounded really great. We got the singer is actually a guy on camera singing it.
Pete Atherton, the guy.
And he did a great job.
He's from Vancouver, and he just kind of came in and listened to Christian's demo and recorded it.
There he is right there coming up.
I hope you don't think, Browning, because my name ain't up on this wall, that I owe you anything.
If you look real closely at the memorial scene, you'll actually see the real clear.
Yeah, I know, she's in there somewhere.
Listen, don't you ever fucking tell me.
I think this is Kurt Smith. He's, you know, known for his part on Dawson's Creek, but he did a really good job on this part. You know, he's very, he comes prepared, and, you know, he brought a lot, I thought, some understanding to the bad guy.
Hey, Alex. Hey. I took my.
This is I got a 70 on my driver's test. The guy said you're gonna die at a young age, and so I made it this far.
Yeah, well, anyways,
and there was another thing Brian Witt said.
You're gonna die.
That was a note. No one gets a 70. No one's that bad a driver, and I said I did.
Is that true?
Well, was it Brian or Richard who was actually on the plane?
Whatever.
Yeah, flight 180 when he read the script.
Yeah, there's actually...
Cynthia Pastor is my mother-in-law.
There's actually an executive who, when we gave him the script, he was on a plane. He was on a flight 180 from Los Angeles to New York. He opened the script and started reading it. And he kind of freaked out. So that helped us get the movie made, by the way.
I think that line there, you know, you scared the hell out of me. We had a lot of people say, why, you know, why would he... frighten her. I think that's an older person's reaction. Hey. You know, that Alex would,
hey,
you know, frighten her.
But I just think it's interesting, too, that, you know, different characters have different reactions to what happened. And for the teacher who,
but my father,
you know, is supposed to be the more put sure, together, mature person, that, you know, she's more freaked out than anyone. I thought it was interesting.
Trip to the city, yeah. Catch the Yanks.
She's just not open to new ideas.
Oh, this thing that Todd reads is a passage from
this thing Miss Luton showed me in class. Again, let me read it.
Proust, or Proust, if you're Jose Chung. We couldn't write anything that as good as this passage.
It's now, upcoming, there's a photographer who takes a picture of these two, and in the original ending, that picture plays a part in the ending of the movie, but we don't have that ending anymore, so that picture doesn't show up.
We say that the
on the DVD, they have the alternate ending. You'll see clear looking at the picture of the two of them taken by that photographer in this scene.
I think I could have done a better job on that. Now Willett will come and punch me, but
it may already be gone. Or that death could
on the eagle thing.
Yeah.
This shot was kind of like sort of good luck in a way that the full moon is right there through the trees. It wasn't anything that we kind of planned.
Oh, upcoming here, those pictures on the wall were actually stretched, and they were taken by the first AD, my first AD, Jack Hardy. And you'll see that there's actually two versions of this bathroom. This first one, where if you look, I don't know if you can tell, but the rooms are all askew. They're not at 90 degrees, and all the tile on the floor are not straight to the, you know.
It was John Willett wanted to create an oblique kind of feeling, made the audience a little anxious, and they didn't really know why.
Yeah. So
it might have been because they already coughed up $8.
But if you look down that hall, when we were pushing down the hall, it looked kind of wide angle-ish, but actually it wasn't, because the character himself was not stretched with a wide angle. It was just the walls were.
This is take 23 on this thing.
Yeah, this took forever to do.
And there's still a cutting and dissolving there to have it settle.
People actually bring up, what is the deal with the name of the fan? And I think John Willett just put typhoon as a play on words to not be a product. And because there's so much, of the fan being, sort of death's wind or whatever. But there's nothing, no inside thing.
Someone will figure something out to attach to it, I promise you.
So there's USA Today on the background. They gave us a bad review, so we should have.
Yeah, we should put the LA Times there, which gave us a good review. So pretend that's LA Times.
Yeah. Or New Yorker.
Oh, New York, yeah.
The New York Times gave you a good review, too.
Now this, I don't know if we did this right, but when you do research and a lot of the connection between sort of eroticism and death, I don't know if we pulled it off, but that was the attempt here, and at the risk of sounding stupid, I should just shut up.
Well, anyways, people got a kick out of a kid who was going to look at a penthouse. In the script, there was he did a lot more than just look at the penthouse, but we decided...
Not that much more,
but...
Himself, right?
But we decided to kind of curtail
This floor, it took us three times to do this. The tiles are, skewed. If you look at the floor, right there you can kind of see that tile on the lower left-hand corner, but if you walked on it, you could tell that there was kind of
a path that
the water should follow. But if you just looked at it with your eye, you couldn't tell. But it took us three times, and I don't even know if it completely really worked right. I think Jim Coleman's here, cut decent tension into this, because we did 20-some-odd takes of the water flowing on the floor, and it still never really went where we wanted, except for the one shot coming up where it sort of takes a 90 degree angle turn. Hopefully, we're hoping people think here that he's going to get electrocuted.
But he saves himself in time.
You know, watching audiences, they get nervous just when the nose hair clipper goes to the nose. Yes. Go, uh-oh.
This is the only nudity in the show, which unfortunately is very, very brief.
Upcoming is an owl, and what you had to do was get the dog off screen to agitate the owl.
Yeah, the owl is much more difficult to work with than any of the actors, believe it or not.
This actually happened to her. We stole this from our friend's life, Joel Soisson, who produced the second Nightmare on Elm Street. When he was in New York City for the premiere, he and his wife Claudia and Michael Murphy were sitting on the steps of a brownstone. And Nightmare on Elm Street 2 is about to come out, and this piece of paper is floating around and lands on his leg, and it said Joel Soisson. It was a piece from one sheet.
And we had many versions of this, some excruciatingly long, so he died forever.
Well, that was a psycho homage shot. I think Craig Perry helped us out a lot, because he said we need more shots of him slipping under his hand on the rail of the tub, and... Now, that shot, I fought to get in there, even though Jim Wong and Jim Cobbins fought me tooth and nail and called me names. Just thought I added a little creep to it.
His eyes are red now, and that is through the use of contact lenses and special effects that we did.
Although your optometrist commended you.
Yeah, my optometrist said that's what actually would happen if you were going to have that...
And this
strangulation thing happened.
That clothes hanger thing across the tub. When we were writing this, I lived in this horrible apartment in Beverly Hills, and I had one of those in the tub, and I never used it. And we're going, well, how are we going to kill a guy in the bathtub? And that
came in handy.
Yeah, it came into play. This is shot in reverse,
and then run backwards,
so that the water actually flows from beneath there, and the camera goes over
to see Todd, right?
Actually, the fan shot where the lands on his leg was also
right. So that's reverse. Right.
I don't know. We had that one shot where he ran into his own POV, which drives people nuts. But I thought we should have used that. It's too late.
What happened? Where's Todd?
I remember we had really real problems with the glare on the corner van and the ambulance. So if you look at it, there's just a mass of goo on each side of those vehicles.
When we tested this movie, there's a couple of times we tested it. We did not have music in this scene. And when we finally did the final version, you know, we really felt that the scene could be helped emotionally with the music, and surely helped us a lot with putting music into it.
Yeah, I mean,
he wouldn't do that.
We couldn't be bigger fans of Shirley Walker than that theme of this. When we first heard it, that reoccurring kind of death theme, we just said, we can't hear enough of that. And she just did a terrific job.
And the music really helped Devin here, because the feeling was that he didn't show enough care for his friend just being killed, so... Music really, really helped that.
And again, of course, I had the crane. I had to use it.
Art Schaefer would come and scold you.
This shot, the leaf falling, took us literally half a day. And there was a string that was attached to it that, of course, is painted out.
Which actually... If you look at the deleted scene, that's the reason you have the leaf.
Right.
At the end of the movie,
there's a leaf in the original ending that you'll see in the DVD versions.
I wish the way that dog walks across the screen, like I'll kick him or something. But he's just going over to the trainer off screen.
Focus even now, just 1 week into summer, you can...
This artwork was done by an artist up in Vancouver.
Oh, yeah, Todd saw Sasha.
And this was when we shot here, and it comes into play later at the climax of the movie. But, you know, 10 feet to the right and left there is protected area. So we had to have that roped off, and you had to have permission to set foot into that area, because there's a little stream where the salmon
Not to mention one of the...
Yeah, they spawn or something.
Whatever.
They did something there anyways. But in fact, at the end of the movie, you'll see that there's a big old pool that gets destroyed and water runs out. And we couldn't let that water run into the creek, so we had to build cisterns that held, you know, these hundreds of gallons of water.
That stream didn't help our sound either.
Right. Yeah. And you see what Claire has in her hand now.
This is
you never noticed, but it's a can of turpentine that will also play in the end of the movie.
It's you.
Springy head guy wasn't in the script. We made it up
on the set
because yeah, the artwork. This scene. After screenings,
we
cut about a minute out of it.
Right. I think people wanted to get the movie going, and so there's a whole bunch of dialogue that's missing,
including a line where she says, "I'm not into any of that X-Files bullshit," which always got kind of a chuckle.
I didn't even know where those emotions were coming from until you started freaking out. I didn't see what you saw. I felt it. You can still feel it, can't you?
Interestingly, when we shot this, maybe not so interestingly, when we shot this, my first intention of shooting this, the scenes were to do it all in two shots. And I did that, and then we watched the dailies, and immediately realized that I had to come in for coverage. So parts of these scenes were shot at different days because after watching dailies, you realize, I need to shoot some more stuff.
Which helped us cut out some of that dialogue.
Exactly.
Of us.
Is this something that you're feeling?
I don't know. You know what? I just wanted to see him again. One last time. So maybe I would know.
Then let's go see him.
Now this also is a set that was built. And when you look at the kids coming in to the mortuary here, breaking into the mortuary, you'll see Devin's face right there, but when he gets out of frame, the stunt guy replaces him. So both of these people are stunt people dropping into climbing down onto this. It was actually quite high. It was like 20, 30 feet high, this set. So that's how we did that. And then, of course, once everything settled, the actors got back into their position.
This place. I'm not supposed to.
It seemed like you couldn't have a movie about death without going into a funeral home and a mortician and all that, because I think that's something that bothers everybody about what happens to your body once you're gone. And also, this kind of sounds kind of pretentious, but this character coming up is sort of a, you know, in myth you always have that creature at the edge of the forest that gives you a hint as to what you're supposed to look for. So it was nothing kind of more than a this guy giving Alex a hint. Somebody who knew about death.
Yeah, that's him.
You always knew that this was going to work with the audience, too. You kind of sat there and you go, man, everyone's going to freak out in a minute. It's a little cheap.
Hey, it's cheap, but we'll take it. In the set here, you look down that way. We purposely planned for the basement set not to be finished, so it looks like some kind of cave they came out of. Because, you know, he was going to tell us the rules, so we didn't know if he was going to be...
chemicals.
He was devil incarnate or death or whatever. So
very specific.
The background there would look like a cave that he walks out of.
This is Tony Todd, Jim and I wanted to cast in a show that we did a long time ago called The 100 Lives of Black Jack Savage. Don't ever look for it. And we're always fans of Tony and... You know, I hadn't seen the Candyman movies when we cast him. I looked at him afterwards, and his character is actually named William Bloodworth,
right?
Who is that's our actual registered pseudonym. Like together, we've written one script that aired by Bill Bloodworth, who was a character in a booker that we wrote, and sort of a good luck name that makes its way into a bunch of our stuff. Cigarette Smoking Man episode, his pseudonym was Raoul Bloodworth.
Right. And I don't know if Tony wants me to tell you this, but He sweats more than anyone I've ever seen in my life. That shirt, we had to, after the first rehearsal, we had to wait 15 minutes for the shirt to dry.
Your friend's departure shows that...
No, Chad, I don't know if we've passed it.
Yeah, we just did. We saw his eyes blink, and it was a mistake of ours that we didn't correct.
It's coming back
at me. Yeah, his neck is pulsing, too. That happens in Psycho.
If you think you can get away with it.
Then we're cool.
But remember...
We actually had a note one time, can't we trim this part down? Why do we need this? But it always, Devin's reaction afterwards, where he goes, yeah, well, it always...
Gotta laugh.
You gotta laugh. And also, you know, it's another thing, like, why do they have to do this to you after you're dead?
Yeah. It's good, it makes people uncomfortable.
Yeah.
It's good for the film.
But we had I had a job one time, and I was a courier, and I delivered to a mortuary, and the things in this laboratory, whatever, what really bothers you is, you know, hairspray and toothbrushes and household objects that are in a mortician's office.
In that scene, we had we did some more explaining with Tony's additional dialogue, that in the overhead shot, that's not really what he was saying, but it fit perfectly.
Just by sitting here, by sipping this coffee.
Now, you watch a scene. This is one time when we're outside that it actually rained quite a bit. And we did this scene over 3 days. So the weather changes from the beginning of the scene to the end of the scene quite a bit. But I think Rob did a really good job in trying to match it. And you never notice it, that, for instance, I think at this time it's probably raining.
Yeah, actually, there was a scene before this that was deleted.
Oh, right.
Where Alex was talking about, you know, what was the gate number? You know, 46. How many kids from our class went? 46. The time of the departure was the same as my birthday, and all these elements. And behind there was a crane that had some more kind of jeopardy to him, which you'll see, which later, there's a crane back there. There was a scene that took place back there. And
I want to hear you.
Which is really a cheat for the bus hit, because there's no way a bus could get that much velocity going down the street right there. But no one really ever seemed to notice it. I don't know, the reflection.
Well, the reflection that you saw that Alex just noticed. We just did a live with a bus and pulled it around the corner so you couldn't see it. But it ended up too short, so we had the aerial add length to the bus so that the bus never seems to leave the window until you see the street.
And that kind of wasn't in the original script. All that the visions was something that Richard Brenner and Bob Shea said that they wanted Alex to get.
Right.
You know. Originally, we had a 2-pack. If I Die Tonight, which I think kind of worked better, but at the last minute, literally the last minute of the sound mix, we were told that we couldn't get the rights to the.
So we put in the Nine Inch Nails songs, which worked okay, I thought.
And had the words Final Destination.
It did have, yeah.
Yeah, and the 2-pack song was better.
We couldn't get it anyway.
I forgot to say, Amanda Detmer plays Terry Chaney, who has Lon Chaney worked with Todd Browning.
This also, the Twinkie, there's another scene where Billy was kind of stuffing his face with Twinkies that we cut out. So that the gag with running over the Twinkie would have worked a little better if we had the other scene, but I think ultimately it's better this way.
Now, coming up with the bus thing, what we did is we had two life-size expensive dummies done by, dipping Amanda Detmer in plaster. Like $50,000 each or something. Very expensive. We filmed one pass with her just standing. She walks into the curb and stops.
Jim can explain this.
Coblin saved the day here.
Well, it actually was shot pretty perfectly, except the backgrounds changed tremendously because of the weather. So normally you would just make a cut right where the bus would be coming through, but we couldn't do that. So we ended up using the bus as a wipe from going from one to the other. So she steps in there, and then as the bus comes through, the bus becomes a wipe that would give you the shot with the dummy. So you never saw the background change, and it worked tremendously.
That's really like the best jump out and scare and have them screaming for 5 minutes scene. You know, the bus hits her like probably 3 seconds before you think it's going to, and the audience just freaks out.
We actually added like 30 to 40 seconds more of this Alka-Seltzer stuff, because after the first screening that the scene was almost halfway over before people calmed down enough to hear what was going on.
And the Alka-Seltzer bit we stole from Jaws. It's an homage.
Homage.
The highest form of flattery.
Yeah. But yeah, when we filmed the bus hit, you know, when the bus, you know, drives over this dummy, everyone, you know, when you're there, you go, oh wow, woo woo, and then the next day, at dailies, we were all,
yeah, we're worried.
It just looked like
it didn't look very good,
and we were ready to reshoot it.
Yeah, you know, Jim put it together, and it just worked so well.
Well, we had a lot of coverage from inside the bus. We had all of other stuff, mm-hmm. but it just works better happening.
Yeah. On the possible cause of the explosion of Boeing Air Flight 180. Officials believe deterioration of silicone insulation.
Now, this graphic here, compared to our next graphic, is totally different because the computer artist that we use decided to, you know, kind of make it more creative or more exciting looking. So you see how straight the lines are in this graphic, which is how I wanted it, versus the other one that I had on the set.
And this was very worked on by Bob Shea. A lot of Alex's off-screen lines here were helping to define what the plan was, and you know how it worked. That the path of the explosion was the design, and all this stuff. Most of his dialogue here came later, after the screenings and the reactions of people that didn't know what the hell was going on.
That was Terry. You're dying the order they would have died. Yes, Death's design. Miss Luton's next.
Now, okay. This house, we actually built this house in 5 weeks. Not the interiors, but all the exteriors. And people in Vancouver were kind of angry at us because they thought it was a great house and they wanted to keep it on the neighborhood that we were shooting in. They thought somebody could, you know, just put, you know, finished the inside and somebody can live in it, but we had to blow it up later.
This is on the set,
yeah.
So it's kind of, you know, tricky to go from the set to the exterior to, you know, Kristen's POV. Now, Kristen Cloak, she was one of the leads of Space Above and Beyond.
Just looking at my own.
We just trust her a great deal. Everything she's been in, we've made her go crazy or killed her, which is kind of a people think it's weird because Kristen and I are married. It's like some kind of domestic weirdness going on. But Jim and I trust Kristen. She knows what we're up to, what we're trying to do, that, you know, how to act opposite a blue screen. Right there, she says, Laura, I gotta call you back, which is Kristen's friend, but the Laura Means character that she played on Millennium, so as if she was calling Laura Means.
Who went crazy.
And, I don't know, I guess Kristen's talking on the comment how he did this, but, you know, we really trust her, and Jim and I find actors that, it's hard to find actors that, you know, you can trust, especially in a lot of the stuff that we've done where you go crazy or you're acting with blue screens or...
Now, upcoming, when Roger takes Devin and puts him in the car... He does this out of nowhere. Nobody knew he was going to do this. He actually really jammed him into the car. And Devin was as surprised as anyone. And after the take, he said, Roger, don't you like me? This is another of the death wind motif that we wanted to incorporate into the movie.
I think this scene intercutting with this, I don't know. The intent, I think, is to create a kind of tension because you know what's happening with Miss Luton. And you kind of want to get to it. You know that Alex is the only one that can save her from getting it. But these guys have detained him.
And pretty soon, for sure, you're going to know. Yeah. It's with a John Denver record.
Now, with the John Denver, I have nothing against John Denver. I like John Denver. But Jim and I have done this as something, it's a neat... It's a weird, whatever, I don't know.
It's a neat
weird
device, I guess.
Yeah, tension, where you play a song that...
favorite.
And you got to find the right song that somewhere is an underlying tension, underlying weirdness to the song that you play while you have some pretty weird imagery. We did in the X-Files with Johnny Mathis. And, I did it in Millennium a couple times, The Love is Blue. But,
So what about
I was surprised that the audience wasn't on to what that was gonna be. But again, that is something, as John Denver, it stems from the, you know, I had that thing in the airport where he had died in a plane crash, and then we just kind of made it as a running kind of,
yeah,
sort of dark humor to it.
But I saved.
I first saw that in Close Encounters. They're coming for the little kid, and I think Spielberg had Chances Are by Johnny Mathis. But also, if you go back to the birds, you know, in the school, and the kids are singing that rickety rackety meow, you know that thing? There's like this, like a little schoolyard chant,
yeah,
a little school song, and there's incredible tension where the birds are amassing. And it's just a sequence type of thing that we really like to do.
Okay, well, upcoming here, when we're watching the screening, people, when they see the knife block, always go, oh, knowing, thinking that they know what's going to happen.
How do they go?
They go, oh.
Right here, this is kind of like that. The motion's kind of crazy.
Yeah.
It's driving me nuts.
You know what happened here is that on these shots, we actually cranked the shutter so that it's much, much closer, so that the shutter speed becomes faster, and there's no motion blur on some of these shots on this side of the camera right here, so that when she moves, it looks different than normal.
You know, she throws that towel over the knives. Comes up later.
Yeah.
But I feel like, you know, at least at the screenings, no one seemed to pick that up like that was coming up.
If you look at if you look closely at the burner, you'll see something strange sticking out of it, which I never really noticed until I'm watching this, actually. There's a flame thing that the special effects guys put in that helps the stove explode. You'll see in the burner. Well, it's the previous shot.
My vote was to play this completely.
It came to our attention at first because
Kristen scene with a John Denver, and fortunately, I think I was outvoted because Shirley, you know, he kept that underneath, and you know, Jim Wong and Jim Goldman's and Shirley felt that we needed some score there. I would have played it just with the Rocky Mountain High.
We pick you up at Val Luton's house. Alex, nobody had
I think this is the second time we shot this. Did we do this twice?
Yeah, we had to do this. We had to do that scene twice because the first time we had a different cameraman, and the scene's out of focus.
As long as I'm in here, it's out of my control. I'm sorry.
This all goes in with Willett's color scheme. He wanted browns and beiges, and the only person that had blue was Tony Todd's character. I don't remember why.
It's cold. It's death.
Yeah.
I think these guys had good chemistry. This gets a laugh in the screenings.
Well, Roger did a great job with his kind of weirdness that he injected into it.
I almost believed him. Can I tell you something? Don't take this the wrong way. But sometimes you give me the creeps.
Now, we had to reshoot this mug because it said something else when we first shot it. So this shot we did in Los Angeles, believe it or not, and with a new mug.
It's like the high school reminding her of the tragedy.
You gotta stop this. Stop this. It's a stupid mug. You're out of here.
That was like, you know, we had some, you know, criticisms like, oh, the movie was really predictable. Like, yo, you knew she was gonna die, but, you know, I kind of feel like,
of course she's going to die.
You didn't know that the computer was going to blow up on her at this point. It's not even introduced.
I mean, you didn't know she was going to die three times either.
Yeah, right.
She would multiple ways,
I think. That was a little kind of... a little like she should have known that was dripping.
You know what?
I'll be quiet.
It's a movie.
We actually painted out some of the dripping because of...
Yeah,
that's right.
But you look at the stained glass window behind her. And it's another one example of the foreshadowing we used in this movie. The stained glass window behind her when she stands up from the scene is a knife that looks like it's kind of plunging into her.
I also didn't get the kind of...
Here it is. There is a stained glass. There he goes.
Mrs. Luton's collection of horns.
Yeah, well, I just picked something from the set because we had nothing going there.
That was done reverse.
Yeah.
The thing going in her neck.
And actually, Bob Shea, after watching the first cut, decided that we shouldn't be so graphic so that we didn't really enhance the shard going to her neck as much as we could have, I guess. This is a...
more of his premonitions.
More of his premonitions. And all these ambers are CGI embers. They didn't really exist in real life.
Well, they're mixed. Yeah, because we shot embers and we supered them over and then we enhanced them with CGI.
Well, the shot that pans over, there were no embers. There was some kind of trickery going on. There's the stove exploding, and that's... all that stuff was done live, physical.
Well, we did. Kristen will explain this, but we had a floor. It's a false floor, and coming up, her body is underneath it, and there's a, you know, kind of a silicone rubber body. This always gets a good ground. And
actually goes into a body.
So it's just her arms and head. The rest of her body's underneath the floor.
And she had to stay in that set like that because it took so long to put her in and make her up. She was underneath the floor for, I think, 5 hours.
And my kids were up there looking at us when we were setting this up, and they just looked at us like, what kind of jobs do you have?
So all this was a fake body on her.
Oh, God, it's loose.
So this is all kind of a weird Rube Goldberg stuff, who was a kind of known in the doing kind of comedic, kind of like mousetrap game where one thing would lead to this, would lead to that.
This is the reason why that shot with the fountain, there was supposed to be a refrigerator that flew out of the explosion and landed in the fountain. But of course you don't see a refrigerator flying out because it never happened.
All around on the other side, there was a lot of people to watch us blow that up that night, and it was taking a long time, and people in the neighborhood were going, come on already, let's go.
Just blow it up.
It's not talking to me.
Yeah, once you blow it up once, you can't do it again.
The other thing, this is cut out, that her artwork was right here in a scene. We cut some stuff out. She built her artwork. The metal was made from, she had gone to the beach.
Yeah,
and made her sculpture from debris from the crash, and that's why he's going, nice artwork, was supposed to be a little tension.
But since you didn't know that, it doesn't really work that way.
Which is a thing I've seen other people asking, how come she knew where to go? Yeah, because she had said, I went to the crash site, and he said, oh, I always wanted to go there, and we cut that out.
Now that shot of Billy, he actually fell off the bike and was apologizing there. But we made it part of the film. Yeah.
It was an unintentional great moment.
And that the memorial, John Willard had put a bunch of people from the crew, and a couple of them said, get my name off of there.
Yeah, they thought it was bad luck to have a name, have their name on a memorial that said they died, so we had to...
I don't blame them.
Yeah, well, we had to redo that at great expense, actually.
See if I go to Alex. That's why you're taking me.
Why would I want to see him?
Because he knows which one of us is next.
This upcoming scene, shot this just actually. This is one of the quickest things we ever did. We did this in one night on this bridge that we closed down. We didn't really close down. We just kind of allowed traffic to go around us when we. Well, we had a car in front with a crane to shoot this shot upcoming.
And the song in the background, a friend of ours and my assistant up there, Julie Ng, had sent me a cassette. Here's a bunch of songs you might want to use in the movie, and it was on. This is one of the songs. She gets no money for that.
Now, this is interesting that this part of the scene is actually out by the beach, as you'll see. And she walks through the little thicket of plants here.
Which you had to put there.
Yeah, we had to put the trees there because I wanted her to walk through this maze of trees to get to the beach. So this is actually a beach in real life. And but to shoot at a beach, the sound would be no good because of the waves and the water. So all this part is on the set. This is the set right now.
So I'm just kind of, I don't know, to bring up this, the story she tells here. I mean, when I was a kid, I always had a concern about my parents dying. And the story she's about to tell, I worked on a film called Trick or Treat in North Carolina, and I met a family down there. And what Clear says happened to her father is what happened to this family that I knew. And you just kind of felt, why did this horrible thing happen to these really good people? And I know, you know, that was 15 years ago, and I always kind of remembered it.
Well, originally, I think the idea of fate and cheating death, living your life to the fullest, and, you know, are our lives predestined from the time we're born? I think a lot of those themes really influenced me a lot.
And a guy blew his head off.
You know, this scene, you know, got cut down.
But yeah, the end of this scene is different in this version than it is on the original ending version. Because they make love at the end of this scene in the original version of the movie. So we this scene we cut down.
I mean, there was some criticism, I guess, about using this situation with the tragedy that happened to the class in Pennsylvania.
It exists, that place.
And when the script and the scene that's deleted, you know, was much more, made the movie much more about, you know, hang in there, that there's another life, that even if there isn't an afterlife, there's another one that comes after we go. And hope, you know, we wanted it to have more of a message of hope. And I have to admit to having some remorse now, you know, hoping that you know, those families aren't, you know, hurt by this.
All right, Brownie, fucking warlock. Did you know about
but
or what?
Certainly had no intention of exploiting that situation.
Billy told the FBI I saw you running from our house.
I hadn't been influenced by any of the plane crashes. Unfortunately, there were a couple of reviews that really lambasted the film, saying, oh, you know, it's obviously, you know, taking a page from these tragedies, and it's really disgusting. And the project was written long before these crashes occurred, so we were very worried about that as far as marketing goes, too, with the film. So that was kind of a fine line that the studio had to walk.
Coming here, when we shot this scene, I don't know if you noticed, but we were just going around and around in a circle. So, in the background, you'll see, I think Jim did a good job in making it so that you didn't notice any of that, but the background does repeat if you watch very close.
There's a New Line guy wanted us to take out that line about the Jets, and I said, are you kidding?
No.
Well, you know, when we were making the movie, I thought the Jets were going to the Super Bowl, and then on the very first game of the year, Testaverde went down, and I said, okay, well,
we're safe.
That joke's safe. Sorry, Jets fans.
We just got rid of...
You let me decide how to...
I hope we didn't jinx them.
Because we're all on the same list.
Also, you know, our actors threw a lot more Joe Pesci-like language than was in the script, and we kept telling him, you know, ease off because it loses its kind of power. But I don't know, they're in that moment, and
why wait any longer?
They start at it, and it's hard to bring that down.
We had we shot all the car stuff outside, all this stuff here, way before we had the interior stuff, so it was very difficult to try to lay out where you're coming from and where you're going to. Actually, I laid it out with storyboards we shot and put them in for where the people were actually speaking inside the car to see if I was even close.
Yeah, this Tom Wright shot second unit stuff, all the car drive-bys and stuff. We had worked with him on Space Above Beyond and Millennium and others, and, you know, Tom designed stuff for Hitchcock, and he worked on Apocalypse Now, and did the Met paintings for the Hindenburg, and the paintings for Night Gallery, unless he's lying. But Tom's a good friend and a very,
very talented director.
I could kill my dad, not to prove that how big your balls are, not now!
Now, oh.
The elbow?
The elbow. The reason why we had the elbow gag in there was that actually Sean came onto the set one day and he had a problem with his lip. We had to hide it with makeup, and we thought, well, the perfect way to hide it is if he had some blood coming down the side of his mouth. So that's why we put the elbow gag in there, just so that we can, you know, have blood coming down the side of his mouth.
And before, that bit used to be that you saw Billy's head in half.
Right.
Like decapitated, and Bob Shea said we need something else, and so you guys came up with the train.
Yeah.
I don't want to make it sound like Sean. Women shouldn't flood after Sean. It was just like a cut or something.
Yeah, it was just, no, it was nothing wrong with him.
But just, we filmed this scene first, and so we hit it with a cut with makeup, and then shot the previous scene afterwards, and included the punch to it.
Move the fucking car!
For this train, we had three different trains that actually came. One was a full length, well, not full length, but 20 car train we shot. One was a 6 car train, and one was just a, what they call a high railer, which is just a pickup truck, and we put a fake front of the train onto the pickup truck, onto the track. So upcoming, the trains that you see is a combination of the long train, the high railer, and the shorter train. The shorter train was the one that we used to actually hit the car with.
Possibly the oldest gag in the world was a full-length, huge mirror.
That's right.
At an angle that the train actually drove through, and the way the camera was positioned made it look like it was going right through the camera. This is filmed at a time in Vancouver where basically it gets dark. We start shooting at 10 at night and it gets light about 4:30, so you only had 6 hours a day.
I think we took 5 days to shoot this.
And all that, the inserts of the seatbelt melted it down the stage about 3 weeks later.
All these shots coming up where the actors and the trainer are in the same frame. This is a mirror shot. That's a mirror that we used. Right there is another mirror. And those are mirror shots.
So it saves you going a generation to doing a visual effect or anything. It's actually shot.
And this is a nice shot. When I saw the dailies, because I got up there late, I was thinking, what the hell are you doing? And Jim and I kind of had an argument about it. And he was absolutely right. I was all twisted around just to it. I thought the guys fell on the other side of the car.
I saw the belt.
Scared now?
And I would have cut to that little piece of metal more often, but Jim Collins was right and said, well, just do it once.
You're in that corner! I'm saying the bus away!
Now this part of it was shot with the full train behind him, so that we had more time to run dialogue.
We actually added to the tail end of the train, so it's still behind him.
Yeah, the end of the shot is all CGI train, because
this is CGI there.
Right, CGI train right there.
That was a blue bag dummy where you put a blue bag
on his head
and a blue bag on the stunt man there. And Terry had the effects guy had this arm.
Right, that held a shard and cut his head off.
Now this stuff there, that bit there with the Carter character is wet himself. That was something New Line said take out of the script. And then when we got there, Kerr said, how come that's not in the script anymore? I like that. So considering that the executives were 1,200 miles away.
Yeah, we put a fake pee on him.
And if I see that's
fake.
Yeah, he's holding a lot of water.
What do you got now?
And this is kind of, I don't know, maybe it doesn't work at all, but this is like the riskiest thing that he just, script-wise, is that he just saw his friend killed, and he'd been through this thing with the train, and he's talking about the design. We try to find a more, elegant place to put it, but it just seemed like if we, you know, kept their intensity high, and people, other characters said, you know, you're losing your mind, then it may not draw as much attention. I don't know if it worked or not.
No, one of my favorite lines is, you just saw the decapitation, and she says, you go to the cabin, get your head together.
No, that was inadvertent. This was a cabin that was used for Lake Placid, that John Willett, he was a production designer on Lake Placid, and they had moved it down from the state park, and so it was there. And this is the interior. This isn't a set on a stage. This is the inside of that cabin. Hopefully Dave Kelly won't mind too much.
So the canned food that Devin just got out of the box was actually Underwood chicken spread, which I always remember liking a lot. But Devin, after one taste, wouldn't have anything to do with it. So we had to replace all the chicken spread with, I think, tapioca pudding.
The idea here is that he's trying to prevent death from getting any foothold. So he has a little water around the lantern in case it fell over. It would put it out, and he's put...
He's putting gloves on so that when he opens the can, he wouldn't accidentally get cut somehow with the can lid. And he's using a plastic spoon, and he's eating very soft food, hence the chicken spread.
I like that stuff, too.
Yeah, I think it's good.
Of course, he is factoring in botulism.
Well, that's why you have canned food, but...
You know... If it's time to go, it's time to go. Now, the next shot he leaves is backwards, isn't it?
No, yes it is. The next shot next shot you'll see is... Actually, not this shot, but this shot is run backwards, and shot backwards. And there was another scene that came before this scene, but in the final version, we took it out, because that's where... Ellie discovered she was pregnant.
The Clear character took a pregnancy test because they had made love on the beach, and test screenings, people started to kind of get very uncomfortable, and you could tell that we were losing them.
So hence, nobody gets pregnant anymore. Now, upcoming this shot, we... Never had this shot in the movie until we saw the cut, and I thought we needed something, so we shot that in Los Angeles.
Rested. Tetanus. Nice one. I overlooked it.
I like Shirley's score here, too.
But I caught you. You fuck.
Yeah, there's a sense of the craziness that his head is in.
Yeah, they're not forever. But I got this cabin rigged to beat you now.
Well, that was put in. Bob Shea said that we, after a couple screenings, we needed to build up the fact that there was a storm, and those flashes are, I think, Jim Coleman's put in there.
Well, on the cars.
Yeah.
We got lightning.
Yeah, we needed to set up the storm better because we had just cut to this. You know, and this, it had been omitted. But this character had realized that she was pregnant, and now she was going back to look at this picture of her and her dad at the cabin, and we had heard how her dad had died, and that's what had caused her to go out, motivated her to go out to tell the FBI agents, we gotta go find Alex. I think in the new version that doesn't play as well.
No, but it works okay. So we still had to have the FBI agents go out and find Alex, so we just gave her a different line.
What are you talking about?
I'm not turning him in.
And this is the new version that we shot after we shot everything else.
I go with you.
You can't. Clay, you just tell us where he is.
Yeah, so this is shot about 4 or 5 months after.
We will bring him in safe.
Yeah, they had finished. Now, coming up on the news, on the report about Mrs. Luton's death, you could read it if you... she survived by her brothers, Waldo and Farkas. Farkas was a bad guy in A Christmas Story. And that's what my kids always called each other when they were acting out of whack, so...
I never moved. Of course, it asked me to change seats. But
no, he's saying he didn't move. Right. He didn't succeed. For me, he sat next to Todd, but the plane didn't take off, so I don't know. This is a little...
I bought it completely.
I know you did. We had discussions about this.
Yeah, we had discussions about this, and at the end of the day, when we were meeting with New Line, all Mike DeLuca said was, I don't know what he said. All I know is he said, she's next. That's all I care about. So,
she's next.
That's how it ended up, even though some people had problems with the logic of what was said.
And all these are practicals. They blew up the top of the pole. And
yeah, there was, you know, we wanted to do a lot of these effects on a physical, physical effects, because it was, if we felt like, you know, there's been a lot of CGI lately, and it's something that you come to expect. And we were hoping that by doing these physically, meaning without the help of a computer to generate the effects, it would, you know, it would have a different feel. Now all of the sparks and the lightning is augmented.
Yeah, but there were actual we had actual, you know, sparklers, I guess you call them, on the wire, upcoming, and so all the lights and stuff actually existed in real life.
Painted out some wires that were yanking the wire back and forth and stuff. But
there's those Paris Eiffel Towers that Willet had in there.
Now, this dog actually bit Allie a couple of times. So after the first time, she was pretty shy about going near it. And we actually had to use a stunt double in some of the wide shots to get the dog removed from the wire, because the dog was a little bit too amped up.
There were two dogs, like a calm dog and an amped up dog.
The amped up dog was too amped.
Jack Hardy, the second assistant director, shot that one Saturday night. None of us knew he was doing. This is about an hour outside of Vancouver, and a lot of this area is a very protected area, and so these are all, you know, there's a camera on the ground, there's a high kind of a rails, camera set up on rails there, and we just kept shooting in the same direction. We use a low angle, use a high angle.
Yeah, it looked like you're running through a much bigger forest, but we only had a certain, like maybe 100, I think 100 feet, maybe 50 yards of forest to run through. This is the pool that we talked about that filled with all this water. When the water dumped, they wouldn't allow us to just have the water drain into the little river they had there, so we had to build this system where the water could be recycled through.
And now Mike Wrench and I shot that stunt, but then you did this part with the stick about 2 weeks later. Mike Wrench kept sending that stuntman down the hill. Like, enough, we got it.
There's that water that we had to, you know, pretty much recover from the ground. And when she was fooling the dog, that's when the dog bit her. On the set.
When we wrote the script and we went in to shoot this, there's sort of deaths coming by. Jim said, you know, we're getting the dog, we're killing the dog, because death is, you know, mean bastard, and
they show you how bad
death is, and everyone said the dog is not dying, and so we bailed on that very early. This is actual tree.
Yeah.
It was on a hydraulic pole, so you could, you know, attach a hydraulic pole so you could lift it and do it again and again.
So we had the dog, a fake body of the dog, all planned out.
See, this is all the same area. This is a high angle coming down, but they just ran past. Those guys with the flashlights in the background, they're on the border of restricted forest. You couldn't step over there. So they had guys to say, get out of there.
No, we had a shot to pan from them, from the owl on the branch to them that we had to trim out.
Bob Shea kind of felt that this cutting back and forth was a little too much, but, you know, I don't know what else to do.
This roof set is interesting, too. Part of this is on the location, and part of the roof was actually on the set that we had, because we had Allie up so high on the roof here that some of the set, like right here, is actually on the stage, where it's only like 2 feet off the ground.
And there's no glass in that window, but she's about to put her elbow through it. That's on the stage.
That's on the stage. Good.
This was actually after we built a plane, after we were done with the plane, John Willett built this set on top of the gimbal, so this is 20 feet off the ground also.
Now, we actually, in setting this location, making this garage, we actually improved the house that was on location and added a garage to it so that we can wreck it. And this part of the movie, there's a turpentine can that we saw her hold earlier.
Now, this begins really basically the beginning of the new
ending,
the reshoot. This was done 4 or 5 months later.
And when we did the reshoot, Allie's hair was already blonde. So we had to recolor her hair back to brunette, and we wanted her to have a change when she goes to Paris for the end of the movie. So just in this little sequence here, we had to do her hair a couple of times.
But this is a mix of the old and the new.
Which, you know, you reshot that, but then we went back and used the old version.
This is the old version. This is a new, on Devin's side, the new version, and Allie's side, the old version.
Because in the old version, which like, I guess is on another track, he picks up the wire here and
dies.
In the original draft of my script, the character of Clear, who was named Kimberly in my script, was pregnant. We find out that she's pregnant, so basically death can't get her at the end of it because she has an innocent soul inside of her. So, you know, we have this really happy ending. We're at the emergency room, and she gives birth to a beautiful baby girl, and everybody's like, oh, and there's like happy music, everybody's smiling, and all of a sudden, like, the lights start shaking, and the hospital room starts, you know, trembling, and all of a sudden, the figure of death comes roaring through the doors and races up to her, and this camera goes black. So we don't actually see her get taken, but we know that death has basically got her now because the innocent soul is out of her. So that was definitely more of a shock ending, but I think it really worked as far as the movie goes. And in the first draft of the Wong and Morgan script, or, you know, in the early versions of that, I know it ended on a much happier note. You know, Alex sacrifices himself for Clear, and she's left alive at the end of it with a child, and Carter's alive as well. And, you know, it's very uplifting and different than your average horror movie. I think it worked thematically. But as far as an ending to a horror movie, unfortunately, you know, test audiences, they wanted something more at the end. They wanted to build up and to leave on a rush.
Believe it or not, this is another set where we built the outside of the garage on a stage because we couldn't go back to the old one, to the old location. So all this new stuff was on a stage in Vancouver.
Hold on, Alex. Come on.
But here, this is totally Jim's idea. I think it's a neat idea, making, you know, that's a
near-death experience tunnel thing.
And I hate putting on the 6 months later. That was something that film school, they said, it's for hacks. Maybe that says it all, but I didn't know any other way to put it in there.
And that's that poor's perspective again. I love that.
And we've had a set that was an airplane. This is actually shot in an airplane. We flew an airplane to our location in Victoria and had 4 hours to shoot this sequence.
I just can't believe we got on a plane again. You know what I'm saying?
And what happened is, you know, the test scores were okay, and New Line said we want a new ending. Jim and I went to the Formosa Cafe on Santa Monica.
Had a couple of martinis.
Had a couple of Glenlivets and said, okay, they go to Paris, and
this is it. Now, this is actually shot in Victoria. We wanted to go to Paris, but they wouldn't allow us to go. I don't know why. Maybe it was too costly.
Voilà.
But it looks pretty good, I think, if you're not French, wow. Then you'll buy it.
It's weird being here, huh? We finally completed a puzzle. So there's something missing.
And, you know, New Line thought this was an opportunity to further clarify Death's design.
God.
So it's a little bit like the end of Psycho when the guy came in to explain split personalities a bit, but
what?
It's in there.
You would have told me 6 months ago that three of us would be sitting here having a drink.
Also, Jim bailed on the color scheme.
Yeah.
The color palette, which I think is a good idea. It's like the blue and the black look of the reshoot. This was a controversial shot.
You were right, Brian.
Because I felt that we needed to cut to that guy. Coblenz threw me out of his editing room.
Yeah, we won.
Said, don't come back.
I think the only thing we won.
But the audience kind of laughs because, you know, something's up. He's sitting here with his arms folded. He's going.
Yeah,
but I think it's funny.
There's just something.
Yeah, but by the way, it was supposed to be a year later, actually, when we first wrote the new ending. But it was so cold in Victoria that you see everyone's bundled up and you see their breath. And we thought, well, you can't pretend this is summer. So we made it 6 months later.
It skipped him and went to the next person.
And that's the outfit that it's... you can buy actually on the New Line website. The outfit that Devin's wearing is the one you can buy. You can bid on. So here, okay, it's crazy, but it's true.
This isn't exactly what was meant to happen. That out of everyone on Flight 180,
just so of the idea. Rocky Mountain High in French.
Yeah, the singer is singing. It was his own version, his own translation of Rocky Mountain High. Because we couldn't find a official translation of that song.
And hopefully, if you're wondering if we all took ourselves real seriously, that that would kind of put it, you know, that there was a lot of dark humor. You know, some of those things that, oh, they don't know if they're trying to be funny, and that's what's so sad, but you know, we're trying to be funny.
This the whole meat truck idea was from Clear, our assistant, because she's been to Europe and she has great disdain for their sanitation.
She's kind of a deer hunter.
Yeah.
Homage when she drinks the wine on her wedding dress.
Yeah, I'll go with you.
No drop spills.
Just stay here, okay, Clear? Just stay here, right?
See, it's true. I told you were next, man.
Stop it, Carter. Alex, wait.
Now coming up, when Carter knocks Alex aside, you have to watch a stuntman in the lower left-hand corner. He really knocked his head on the ground. He's staying in the hospital.
There's that stuntman who had to go to the hospital right there.
And there was some controversy over the sign because he wanted to make this ending economical, and they go, oh, you know, like a sign that hangs over a thing. And Jim Long said, no. A big sign.
It's, yeah, it's probably the biggest sign.
And there's that 180.
Right there, bang. Ouch.
I told you were next.
And that's shot in front of a green screen.
So who's next?
So Kerr has to react to nothing.
And that's it.
Hi, it's Jeffrey Reddick. I hope you all enjoyed watching Final Destination as much as we did making it. And take care.
My name is Jim Wong. I directed this movie.
I'm Glenn Morgan, I'm the writer-producer.
I'm Jim Koblenz, the editor.
And thanks for listening.
I'm not scared of dying, and I don't really care if it's peace you find in dying, let the time be near. If it's peace you find in dying, when the dying time is here, then bundle up my coffin, cause it's cold down there, yeah, it's cold down there, yeah, it's crazy cold down there. And when I die, and when I'm gone, there'll be one child born in the world to carry on, to carry on. Shovel.